This is A Story of Sorts, the podcast mostly about bookish stuff. Hello everyone, Karina here. On this episode, I chat with Tika Viteri about writing, gatekeeping in literature, and witch renaissance, among other things. It was a very long talk, and we had loads of fun. Have a listen. Tika, welcome to A Story of Sorts.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I live in Oakland, California. I work for an investment manager in San Francisco. So I work in the financial district in a fancy high-rise building. Mm-hmm. And I come home to my lovely apartment full of books and plants and cats and write for Book Riot on the side.
That is very interesting how from the finance and the book side, how they both connect with each other.
Yes, it's interesting. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that? How did you start writing? Do you do any other freelancing besides Book Riot?
I don't.
It's like
I don't.
Me.
I actually am not a writer with a capital W. I know with Book Riot, we know a lot of people who write for Book Riot and then also write on the side. They have published actual books like adults. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am not one of those people.
Yeah, like me. The only freelance gig I have right now is Book Riot. So
yes.
But
yes,
how did this happen then? How did you, I am assuming you were always interested in economics or finance and then you found freelance writing?
It's actually kind of the other way around. So I work in the human resources department. So I don't actually know anything about finance and economics.
Okay. I see.
I was going to be a teacher, but as you probably know, teaching, especially in the United States, is a really difficult gig. Mm-hmm. And I am lucky enough to have several teachers in my mom's generation of my family. And so they talked me out of it.
Oh, seriously. It's funny because I also had a conversation with Julia Rittenberg a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And she also started out as a teacher. And then she kind of realized after a while, yeah, I am going to give so much of myself for this job and it's not going to pay my bills.
I did. That's exactly why I gave up.
Did you ever try though? Because you is that your education? Was that what you learned at university?
It was, yes. So I got to the very end of my master's degree in education, which doing your student teaching.
Yeah.
And I did my student teaching and I really loved it. But one of the things I noticed is that the teachers around me didn't have the freedom that I did because I was just a student teacher. So I could experiment and try things and they were more bound by the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to, if I had been able to maintain that being a student teacher, like that energy, that would have been wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, also having to deal with the administration. So I took those skills that I learned as a student teacher and transferred them to human resources, which it turns out is very similar. Surprisingly, it's solving a lot of problems for people, asking a lot of questions. People are constantly coming to me with puzzles that I get to solve.
Wow.
So I really like it. And I do a lot of our onboarding, which means that new employees, they get the full experience of my actual teaching expertise.
So basically you never really made it a career, but it's that you got to show me. I know people are not going to see it.
Come here,
but
bug.
I didn't even
I'll
realize
send you
if
a
it
picture.
Was, is it a cat or a dog? I didn't even realize.
It's a cat.
It's a cat. Yeah, if you put a picture, then I will put it on the post that I always make for Instagram
sure.
So people can see it because it's so cute.
I'll send them to you. This is September.
Wow.
And she is named for September in Cat Valenti's A Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland novels.
So from a book.
Yes, they're all named from a book. There are three of them. They're all gray. You don't have to be able to tell them apart from where you are. That's fine.
So if I see another one passing, it might be the same one or another cat.
It'd be a different one.
What are their names then? Now I'm curious.
There is September Theodosia. There is Wednesday Hermione, and there is Wogglebug Strange.
That's okay. I get the middle one. The other ones, I don't know the characters.
Wogglebug is a character. He was named after a character in the Oz books. I think it's in the fourth or fifth Oz book. And Strange is for Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. My good friend's nine-year-old son, when I got Bug, my good friend's nine-year-old son was reading the Oz books, and I picked up the kitten and I showed it to him, and he said, "Well, that looks like a Wogglebug." And that is how that came about.
Super cute. I always love when cats or dogs come in the Zoom meetings.
Yes.
Everybody takes some time to look at them.
Yes.
So
my coworkers are familiar with my cats.
Oh, because they are usually around when you're working.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah, because you're working from home now, I'm imagining.
Yes, we're working from home until September.
Okay. We were talking about teaching, and of course, mm-hmm. teaching can be quite a complicated profession. And yeah, I was talking with Julia, as I said, about it. But then how did you start writing and freelancing, or was that before you went to university?
That's a good question. So I had a blog back in the 2000s. And I made friends with several people who ended up writing for Book Riot over the years. One of them being Alice Burton, who mm-hmm. writes with us. One of them being Amanda Nelson.
Yeah.
And we all had this group of people who were like-minded and really liked GIFs and blogged together. And so over the years, I kept telling people, you should go write for Amanda's company, go write for Book Riot. And then I never did it myself. Finally, I got an email from Amanda saying, get it together. Just send me something. So I did. And then that worked out fine. So mm-hmm. finally, the last one of all my friends to join the group.
I was going to ask you about what's your favorite thing to write, because I really want to know if you also write fiction, because mostly for Book Riot, we write mm-hmm. nonfiction, or we write stuff about books and essays, etc. Right. But do you write fiction as well?
Ugh, no.
That was such a visceral response. I want to know more.
I let other people do that. My fiction, I have attempted to write fiction and it is horrible. And as a person who writes about writing, I would not want to be I think about what people would write about my fiction and it goes directly into the trash.
But you tried it though. I mean, you did write fiction.
We're talking a page and a half. Let's not get excited.
But have you showed someone your writing?
No.
Oh, but no. Then, yeah. What about school? Did you have any kind of a feedback from teachers? Nothing.
I have never taken a single creative writing class, which could explain why my fiction is so bad, to be fair. But it's just not, they talk about, people will say they have narratives going in their heads, or they have mm-hmm. characters in their heads, and authors always talking about how they're interacting with their characters in their heads. And my head is empty of that kind of behavior. The only person I hear in my head is my good angel and my bad angel. And usually it's the bad angel and telling me don't do that thing, or you should probably get up off the couch and stop messing around on your phone. But I've never been a person who came up with characters. I never really liked dolls as a child. I never wanted to create storylines and characters. Mm-hmm. So I have always left that up to the to the professionals.
So basically what you like writing, you always liked writing, I'm assuming, because you had blogs, but it was more objective things that you could have opinions on.
I am very judgmental.
That's great.
I just want to sit with my blog and judge people. And lest we get carried away, the blog hasn't been used since 2012. So it's completely out of date. But it was fun while it lasted.
How did you have the idea to start a blog then? Because usually people like writing, they mostly get get it from reading as well, and it's usually through fiction. I'm making a wild guess. At least it's what I know, what I remember from blogging and books and stuff like that. So how did you start a blog and writing in general?
I think I probably read something I really didn't like and had things to say about it.
Oh yes, that's such a great motivation though.
Petty spite is my motivation.
Do you agree that it's a lot easier to review books that you don't like than books that you like?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Right? Because you have so many things to say about books that you don't like and books you
about
like.
About why
like,
it sucks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's just so petty, but it's also so much fun. And I remember someone on Instagram a few months ago, Casey the Reader, that's the name, I can say it. They made sort of poll or a question asking people, what's a book that you really like disliked? And I think it was also why, something like that. And they had so many responses. And it was like for the weekend, whoa, people are going wild on the opinions. It was either about a book or like a literary opinion that you have that you think it's controversial. And people went wild. And honestly, it was so much fun to see. It was anonymous.
It's so fun.
But yeah.
One of the podcasts that I listen to has a segment called The Hill You'll Die On.
Yeah.
And it has to be stupid. It can't be like, I will die on a hill if people deserve a social safety net, right? Because we can argue about that all day. And it is one of my favorite things because people have the silliest hills that they will die on. And I have my own.
Yeah.
I will die on the hill that Grease 2 is by far the superior Grease movie.
Ooh. That's
see.
I really like the first one, but I did like the second as well. But I think I like the first one more, but when I watched it many, many years ago, because I think if I had watched it now, the power play on that relationship is just so wrong.
It's so wrong.
And the second
and
one
the power play in the second one, it's flipped.
Yeah, but yeah, it's very curious. Never thought about that. I mean,
yeah. So I have been a big fan of this movie for years. And so it turns out this is a less controversial hill than it used to be.
Okay. Yeah, because people are now kind of looking at relationships and thinking, is that problematic? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Maybe. Exactly. Maybe not. Maybe not with that. Like maybe don't turn her into a sex bot if she doesn't want to be one. But, you know, at the same time, everybody needs to be allowed to let their inner cat suit come out to play every once in a while. So, Sandra D, you do your thing, whatever you want it to be.
But not for men, though. Just for yourself.
No.
It's good because maybe this is, I don't know, I was kind of thinking now as we were talking about, like, which hill I would die on. And maybe this is not as controversial as I may think it is, but I do still think that the first Twilight movie is really good.
What?
And like, honestly, like it's kind of like, you know, I usually say I don't have guilty pleasures because you should just like things, but there are things that you really like and that, you know, they are problematic. And those, I think I consider my guilty pleasures. And, but I do still, and again, the hill I will die on is that the first Twilight movie still rocks. I still like, I have the same feeling when I watch it as I did when I watched it for the first time when I was like 20 or 21.
Okay.
So I'll just leave it out there.
That's okay. You're going to die alone on that hill if it's between the two of us, but
I'm
that's
not
okay.
Sure. Okay. Between the two of us. Okay.
But that's okay.
What is the podcast, by the way? Just maybe, I don't know. I can check them out.
I'm not sure that it would be of a huge amount of interest to you because it's mostly U.S. politics, but it's called Hysteria.
Okay. Yeah.
By Crooked Media.
Yeah, but I'll leave it there just if anyone is interested.
Yes. Yes. The hill you'll die on is always a fun one. It's always a good icebreaker too, because people can say things like, oh, no, Or yeah. I'm with you on that hill.
I was kind of thinking, considering just to spice up things on the podcast, maybe bring something similar, but like the controversial take on literature or on a book that mm-hmm. people have. Maybe that's a good one to bring.
Ooh, I've got one for you.
Yeah.
I'm willing to kick off this potential new segment. Yes. My controversial take is that Wilkie Collins is a far better writer than Charles Dickens.
Man, I do not know Wilkie Collins. I feel so bad.
This is the problem. This is the problem. Wilkie Collins wrote one of the first detective novels called The Moonstone. It's delightful. Generally speaking, Edgar Allan Poe is, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh my gosh. Considered. Good grief. Edgar Allan Poe is considered to have written the first like real detective novel. Mm-hmm. Or novella, but Wilkie Collins came along and he wrote The Moonstone. He also wrote The Woman in White, which was written in the 1860s, and it's still creepy as hell. And he's just a wonderful and delightful writer. He wrote some of my very favorite ridiculous side characters. Wilkie Collins, much better. Charles Dickens's best friend.
Yeah.
Wrote better novels.
Okay.
Like they were best friends and he wrote better novels.
Wow. It's curious because I remember, I think it's Amanda. We're talking about Amanda. She really likes Charles Dickens. And I remember that everybody was really talking a lot of good things about the, I forgot the name.
Bleak House?
Something House by Anne Pratchett.
Oh.
The audiobook is by Tom Hanks. It's read by Tom Hanks. And I forgot the name.
Yes.
But the house, something, the house. And I remember that I started listening to it in audiobook form. And I really liked the fact that Tom Hanks was reading it. But it reminded me so much of Charles Dickens and like his stories. There's like this family and the kids and the stepmother that is like this very bad woman. So I couldn't finish it. I even didn't get through it a lot because it just was the kind of pace that after a while it stops interesting me. And I also started reading Charles Dickens and I couldn't finish it. So it's curious that you talk about someone else in comparison to him.
Yes. I think I will say because Dickens was writing for a serialized magazine, it makes sense that a lot of his pieces are, he's getting paid by the word.
If I were getting paid by the word. Yeah.
Definitely.
Mean, I would describe everything.
I will say though, Bleak House by Charles Dickens is widely considered his magnum opus. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it would end up being your jam. And I would strongly recommend reading the first chapter. It is the most atmospheric chapter. Just, it's the most beautiful writing he ever did. Just that one chapter where he's describing London. You can put the book down after that. It's one of my favorites, but I'm not, you know.
Yeah. No, but I can maybe because, again, I've listened also to an audiobook with Richard Armitage. I think I'm pronouncing him right.
Oh, hello.
From you know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was very nice. But after a while, I was like, is this going somewhere? Why is it taking so long? Yeah. So
yes.
I never finished it, unfortunately. So
I really like, so I came up, I grew up on the British 19th century literature canon, and there aren't as many women in it as definitely deserve to be there.
Yeah.
One of the women in British 19th century literature who was extremely famous in her day, again, in the middle of the century, but is not as famous now, is Elizabeth Gaskell.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote North and South. And that is delightful. It is a delightful novel. And I think of it because Richard Armitage is the love interest in
Ooh,
that one.
Okay, so they made it's like an adaptation.
Yes, in the miniseries. And then there's another one she wrote that actually she got to the last chapter and then she passed away. And so it's unfinished, which is such a bummer. I didn't know it. So I'm reading this novel and I was just having a wonderful time listening to it. And you're just waiting for the kiss at the end, right? And then like comes this epilogue that's like, Elizabeth Gaskell passed away and we'll never know how it ended. of course we know how it ended.
Yeah, of course. A book kind of has a pace somewhere, obviously. But
that one is called Wives and Daughters. Mm-hmm. And the audiobook is read by Prunella Scales from the Fawlty Towers series from the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And it is hysterical.
Okay.
It's absolutely wonderful.
A few tips to pick up as well.
Yes.
So
some book recommendations.
So there's going to be more at the end. So tell me about your journey as a reader. When did you become a reader? How did that happen?
I'm one of those terribly annoying readers who taught themselves to read when they were three.
Seriously?
Yes.
Wow.
And has been stashing books under their pillow ever since. I always had my nose in a book. I grew up in a small town in Alaska, and I didn't really fit in with the stereotypical group of kids. And because it was a small town, there wasn't a lot of room culturally and socially for people who were on the outside of the, mm-hmm. you know, the popular circle. So I escaped into books almost immediately as a child and just continue to do so to this day. My dad gave me my first Anne McCaffrey novel when I was probably 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. And so I started reading about dragons immediately. And I still have a terrible softness for any book with a dragon on the cover.
Oh, that's super sweet.
Even though I don't necessarily, like, sci-fi and fantasy are definitely tend to be problematic with a lot of their dynamics, although I think that is getting better, mm-hmm. again, as we as a society kind of examine those kinds of relationship dynamics, writing is as well. That is my journey as a reader. I started out when I was little and just never really stopped.
Wow. Because that's really young.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, yes. It's just really, really young.
It was very young. My mom, I remember being in preschool and they had these series of books that kind of like Dick and Jane novels where you started at book one and then you read them to the teacher and they would give you book two and so you could progress, right? And I remember sitting in preschool reading the first book over and over and over again because I wanted to memorize it. Because wow. I was worried that I wouldn't go to book two if I didn't get book one completely perfect. Because I apparently did not really understand the exercise. So at home, I'm reading chapter books. And at school, they're like, we just don't understand like why she doesn't feel comfortable reading this book to us. And I didn't find this out until years later. My mom was completely mystified by the whole thing.
You don't have to memorize it. You just have to know it.
You just have to be able to like
explain,
stumble through it.
Yeah.
But I thought it had to be perfect. So, yeah.
So you didn't even have to talk to the teacher about what the story was. You just had to read a little bit of it so the teacher could tell how your reading went. Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. So basically you're proving to the teacher that you know how to sight read.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand.
So you memorized it.
So I memorized it. And the teacher was like, and it took me, and I was so concerned about it being right.
Yeah.
That I never actually went to the teacher and said, I'm ready.
Wow.
So I spent a whole year like reading this like little 10-page book. This probably tells you more about my personality than any other story I could tell you.
But it's a very sweet misunderstanding as well. Kind of thinking, okay, if I have to read it to the teacher, they obviously not going to let me look at the book. Because why? I have to prove myself. And obviously I can't read. So what's the only way I have to prove myself to the teacher is by knowing it by heart.
Yes.
Super sweet.
Oh, and, tiny Tika.
Do you have a favorite genre?
I would have said yes, probably a couple of years ago, but I don't think I do. I have genres that I'm into right now. And then I tend to, all genres have their stereotypical storyline, like their set of storylines that they will follow one or the other of. And I find I will get tired of that. Mm-hmm. And then drift away to a different genre for a while and then get tired of their storylines and drift away.
Yeah.
So over COVID, actually, in the last year and a half, I've gotten very interested in mysteries and thrillers, which is something that I would have never said is a genre that I would read.
Really?
Ever.
Oh, wow.
I went through a Stephen King phase when I was 11 and scared the bejesus out of myself.
Yeah, at 11, I can imagine, yes.
I was way too young for those books. As you can tell, my parents just kind of let me read whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
Which was fine, except in this one instance. And I read Cujo, which is about...
Okay.
It's about a rabid dog.
Okay, and because it's a curious thing. Because maybe you can kind of tell me, because I'm a person, I'm kind of afraid of ghosts. Like, even in real life, okay. I'm afraid of ghosts. Like, most people are afraid their house is going to be like, someone's going to be in their house. If I hear something during the night, I think my first instinct is, oh my God, there's like a spirit here in the house, which is kind of, you know, you can't fight the spirit. You can't call the police.
Right. The spirit, it's a helplessness police. that you're afraid of.
But so I cannot watch horror movies with spirits. I can watch, you know, if sometimes horror, but like more, you know, like Saw, it's okay. But
oh no.
But I I'm fine with that. But I read horror with ghosts, like I don't know, the Haunting of Hill House and stuff like that, which is a more, you know, you don't really know what's happening and it could be a ghost. And I'm not afraid. So I'm still kind of waiting for a book. And I read The Shining by Stephen King, thinking I was going to be very afraid. But the only thing I was afraid was of the prospect of being afraid. So I was like, so afraid of being afraid that I didn't even read the book before bed. And then I got to the end and I was like, this was not scary at all. But the movie, I didn't even watch it because I scares the bejesus out of me. So now I'm curious about the rabbit dog.
I think it was at the end of having read multiple Stephen King novels. And that was just the one, that was the straw.
Okay.
That broke the camel's back. And so I was like 13 and I maybe somewhere between 11 and 13. And I remember distinctly doing that thing where you like leap off of your bed so that whatever's underneath it can't get you. And I went and slept in bed with my mom.
Yeah.
As like a full-sized person.
Oh yeah. I can totally relate, but with the ghosts. So.
Yes. Yes. And ghosts don't scare me,
but what's the book about? What scared you so much about it, you know, actually?
It was just that an animal and I think that this is the premise of the book, right? An animal that is supposed to work with humans and that we trust as a beloved pet can go, like, rabies is a very terrifying disease because it affects the brain and it makes the animal or the, you know, it makes the host actually crazy and super aggressive and deadly. Yeah. And it was terrifying to me for some reason that like you could flip a switch in some ways and then like you lose the entire personality that you had before and just become this like killing machine.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That is scary.
But was it that kind of got you to stay far away from thrillers and horror books?
Yes. So I am a big wuss. I can't watch scary movies because I get nervous. I tend to be a little bit jumpy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get inside my own head. And if somebody walks by, like I startle relatively easily. And so I don't do well with movies that have jump scares in them. Mm-hmm. And I can read books because there aren't any actual jump scares.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you're exactly. Just reading through it. It's a twist, but it's not a jump scare. But I'm very affected by soundtracks in movies. Yes. And like if there's like one note that's being extended out, like, and it's psychologically designed to freak you out, right? Yeah. But I just get so worked up waiting for like the ha that I get really stressed out and I can't handle it.
I wonder if there's ever someone who has done like the test of watching a movie, a horror movie that they do not know without soundtrack. Because I think for me as well, I cannot watch like horror movies in that sense that something if I know that the movie doesn't have ghosts, I can watch it. But the jump scares all come from the music, from the sounds.
Yes.
They kind of prepare you that something is about to happen. And I kind of wonder if, yeah, if you, I would be able to watch them, or you would be able to watch them without soundtrack.
That's interesting. I'm sure that they've done, I'm sure people have done
those studies. Yeah, I kind of researched that.
Yeah, I would be interested to know.
Yeah.
I also can't do blood and gore. Okay. So like Saw is way out of my, like that, it's just not going to happen.
So I'm guessing you're not going to read The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones.
You know what's interesting is that I had intended to read that, but I guess I didn't. I have a tendency, especially because we've got Book Riot Slack, right?
Yeah.
So I have a tendency to, people will be like, oh, I'm reading this book. I'm reading this book. It's so good. And I don't, I'll throw it in my queue because people think it's really good without, I don't read the back of the novel.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's been in my queue. And then one of my very good friends who loves, she has taken all of the horror and terror that I can't read or watch, and she has absorbed it into herself. So she loves it times two. And she will text me and be like, I'm reading this book or I'm watching the show and you should not, like, you, this is not Tika approved.
Yeah.
You can't watch it. And she texted our group chat the other day and said, The Only Good Indians is really, really good, but Tika, you're not allowed to read it. And it wasn't until then that I realized that it's
gore.
Like, it's not approved.
Yeah. But the funny thing about The Only Good Indians is I did the same. I heard people say about how good it was. And then I think it was Libra FM with advanced reading copies or listening copies in this case that, like, I got it from them. And then I was like, oh, everybody's talking about this book, so I'm going to listen to it. And you start listening, and that's the thing. Nothing prepares you for how fast and gory things become. You start listening. Okay, I think I had an idea of what it was more or less about when I went into it. I knew it had to deal, it had to do something with deers. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't
that's
sure
about
exactly.
All I knew.
Yeah, and there was these four friends who did something terrible 10 years ago, and now those ghosts of the past are coming back to haunt them, right? And I actually thought maybe it is with ghosts. I want to try out a book with ghosts and see how
Let's
I feel.
See. Sure.
And then, again, a few chapters in, I'm like, oh, this is pretty mild. I don't know why people... And then suddenly, boom! Oh my God, this is very gory. This, but I loved it. Actually, I have an obsession with that book because when I talk about it, I just go kind of, I sound a bit crazy.
That's okay.
Because I loved it so much. And for, honestly, it's a book, I think about it like once a week at least. And every time I think about it in my mind, I'm going insane because it's so, so good. So it's such a shame that you're kind of like, no, I'm not going to read this because I can't. And I totally understand because everybody has triggers, because I really go crazy for that book. It's just so insane.
I feel like I'm old enough and I'm far enough in my reading journey now. I was definitely in my 20s. I was definitely very like, I'm going to hate read this book. I'm going to, you know, I have to finish reading a book, even if I don't like it. And now I'm a little older and I'm like, I don't have time for that nonsense.
Yeah.
If I don't feel like I want to pick up my book, then I can stop reading it. And that's okay. Like, it doesn't have to be my jam. And I don't have to read every book that's ever been published because it turns out that's not going to work for me.
No.
That was a very difficult realization. When I was a child, was that I will never be able to read every book that's ever been published. And I think I was depressed for a week.
Oh my God. Did you have a time?
My when poor
you...
parents.
How do I keep up with this? It's impossible. Like, did you have a moment in which you started DNFing? Cause I also like until my like mid 20s, I always read everything until the end.
Yeah. You read the whole thing. This is Wogglebug.
Oh, so cute. Hey.
He's in the way. You're in the way.
A little gray fox. Super cute.
He is only a year old and he's 13 pounds and he's huge.
Oh, you're perfect.
She says you're perfect, bud.
You are.
So he has anxiety. So he has to come and sit with me every little while. And he's going to be going back to work is going to be rough for him. I try to explain to my boss that I am my cat's emotional support human.
Yes.
And it's weird that she didn't. She was like, yeah, that's really cute.
But you're still going to have to come
you
back.
Still have to go to work. I tried. In any case, so I started DNFing books. I could probably look in Goodreads. So I've been on Goodreads since the beginning, since before they were owned by Amazon, all of that.
Okay.
And I literally only figured out maybe like a month ago that you can just erase a book out of your reading history instead of marking it finished and then tagging it with DNF.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Okay.
So, you know, we're all learning things every day.
I didn't even know Goodreads was not by Amazon at some point.
Yeah, but they were bought by Amazon pretty, like after a couple of years.
I had no idea. I thought they were maybe developed by Amazon.
Yeah, so, I know. So I'm not sure. I've always been able to stop reading a book and then come back to it and say, so I think there are two kinds of books that I will stop reading. Some are books where I'm like, I'm just not into this right now. This is too heavy for me. One of the reasons I really have gotten into mysteries and thrillers, especially on audiobook in the last year and a half, is that I need something to keep that like spinning hamster wheel part of my brain occupied. So there have been several books that I've started recently that are a little bit more on the literary fiction spectrum. Yeah. And I just can't. I can't do it. I don't want to read about messed up families that live down the street from me that just have regular messed up family problems, because I have that in my own family. I don't need to read about other families' messed up problems. I need to read about, like, I need a happy ending, generally speaking, or at least, you know, some sort of like bow on the end of a novel.
Satisfying.
I need the story to close itself up. And, you know, things like, and not to speak badly about this particular novel, but one of the ones that I started and then was not able to continue with because I'm just not in the right headspace for it was The Interestings by Meg Wurlitzer, I think is her last name. And I just couldn't do it.
Not very interesting then.
It wasn't interesting to me.
Yeah. No, of course. It's always personal.
For sure. And my niece and I just had a long talk about this. She's 11. And she was telling me all about how Taylor Swift's music is bad. And I was like, look, kiddo, you can say that Taylor Swift's music is not your jam. It's not about you. Like, you're not about it. Like, that's fine. But if you tell people who like Taylor Swift's music that her music is bad, it's going to hurt their feelings.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's kind of try to temper that a little bit more. Let's make it not quite so black and white. And I think with books in particular, people also have these really deep emotional attachments to genres and to specific books. And so I've learned, like, you can't argue if I'm like, it's not my jam. You can't argue with me if I say this writing is shitty.
Yeah, of course. But it's curious because I have a question for you, and you know about this, about the like the gatekeeping, which I I kind of want to ask you something else, but it kind of goes into that, into what people think it's shit or not, it's bad or not, and how people claim that something is bad when it's just like, it's just not for you.
Yeah, I have very, very strong opinions about that. And
let me just wrap up first. Okay, yeah. But the genre question.
Yes.
And then I'm going to write, I'm going to talk to you about the what you've written for, you have written for Book Riot. But a few years back, you had a favorite genre then.
Mm-hmm.
What was it?
It was definitely science fiction fantasy.
Okay. Yeah,
it's anything with dragons on the cover.
Yeah, because you just talked about the dragons, so that's why I wanted to go back.
I know. I think that speaks to a lot of my, still what a lot of my taste in books is. I like things that are a little bit escapist, things that are not based in 100% reality. And I think that's where, you know, the literary fiction doesn't really grab me as much.
Mm-hmm. It's a curious just thing not as like I used to say I don't have a favorite genre. In the last few years, I kind of realized that my favorite books all fall into the literary fiction genre.
Interesting.
The thing is, I've read, and I don't want to be mean in here, okay? I don't want to sound mean or sound edgy or anything. But last year, and in the last couple of years, I've been reading a lot of books by people of color or Black authors.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, the same. But I did pick up two books this year by white authors. And mm-hmm. I honestly was listening to them and I was thinking, this is such a white people problem, both of them.
Yes.
And it's so unfair because I know that I like books written by white authors about white people, that I love them. Some of my favorite books yes. are like that. But of in course. The last couple of years, like I said, this year I've read, one of them was Transit by Rachel Cusk, which I've heard great things about her and her writing. And I really liked her writing. But the book was like, okay, why do I care about this lady who's having like her apartment rebuilt and then goes to the hairdresser? I honestly wasn't interested. And the other one mm-hmm. was Here We Are by, I forgot his name, Graham Swift.
Okay.
And the same thing. It was a story that I think it shouldn't have been a novel. It should have been a short story. And it was about this magician. And you don't really get to know how he disappeared, which was the only mystery in the story. You just know that it disappeared. And honestly, I got to the end and I was like, I didn't get anything from this book. And I didn't even enjoy the story.
I think that is something. And I actually, I did the Our Reading Lives mm-hmm. article for Book Riot, that's for July.
Okay.
Yeah, and this yeah. is actually, so here's a little preview. My Our Reading Lives was about how I stopped reading any books by cishet white men mm-hmm. starting in 2018. And I haven't yeah. read a single one since. Yeah. And I have missed absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Like, I feel so mean when I say that, because like, listen, I know there are, I mean, white people doing a good job writing. I don't
sure.
mean to, you know,
they're that's writing what I interesting said. Things.
I don't want people to listen to this and think, oh, there she goes being edgy, going against white people. I'm a white person. It's not that. It's not really
right.
not that. But there's so much missing, I think, from those stories. Maybe I was just unlucky, but.
Well, I think that those stories are overrepresented in literature.
Yeah.
If you look at the breakdown of what, who gets published,
yeah,
then it does not reflect the actual, like the percentages of people of color that are in the world.
No,
and
of course.
So if everything were the same and everything were equal in that sense, if, you know, you've got 13% Black population and 13% of published works were written by Black people, then like, maybe we could be having that conversation about how it's mean or whatever, but I don't think that that's the case. And it's because there is racism baked into everything that happens around us.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is not thinking that people of color are, and I'm saying this using air quotes, are as intelligent or have as many interesting things to say. Like, those kinds of things are, like I said, they're baked into culture. And so it makes it more difficult to get published as a person of color.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means is that all of these, you know, I think of them as like the people next door stories are they're overrepresented. And when I stopped reading cishet white men, the reason was not that I was like, ugh, white dudes are awful. It, you know, they can be for
yeah,
sure.
No, of course. Yeah.
And often I can be edgy, often are, but it was because of that overrepresentation in
yeah.
publishing. And it was very easy for me to get lost in reading books that I really enjoyed. One of the series that I stopped reading halfway through because I was in the middle of reading it in December of 2017 is the Expanse series. And I actually really enjoy that series. I think the authors have done a really good job of representing people of color and women in their story in a way that the first novel maybe did not preview very well.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just, it was easy to say, okay, well, I'm going to read this 700-page novel by a white dude, and then maybe I'll get to N.K. Jemisin's Hugo Award-winning books later. And so it was a way to scrape off that first level of books that I encounter and say, okay, if this is a book, like, this is a book that I'm interested in. I really like Grady Hicks. Is that his name?
I don't know.
Somebody Hicks.
I don't know, actually.
Shoot. I forget. Anyway.
It's okay.
The guy, is it Hendrix? Grady Hendrix? The guy who wrote Southern...
You want me to search? I can search it.
Yes. Sorry.
What's
this
the book?
Is terrible.
No problem.
the Southern something guide to vampires.
This is Grady Hendrix. You're right.
Grady Hendrix.
Yeah.
Grady Hendrix is a white dude who writes books that I am interested in reading. So I put them on a spreadsheet. And when I'm ready to read books by white authors again, I will do that. But for now, those books aren't going anywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
They're not going to go out of print. They're not going to be hard to get. And so for now, I'm still exploring authors of color. And one of the genres that I have found that I was surprised by is Afrofuturism.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. It's so good.
I've read, I think, Afrofuturism. Is Kindred Afrofuturism?
I would say so.
Octavia Butler. I think it was. I think that's why we read it in a book club.
Yeah, it's a time-traveling novel. It was definitely ahead of its time, for sure.
It's amazing. And
then if you want to get into like the more sci-fi stuff, the Binti series by Nnedi Okorafor, which is like way out there and super cool and really interesting and also very, very short. Just these books by Black African female authors that I probably never would have... I would have encountered, and I just never would have gotten to them.
Yeah, of course. Unless you are aware of certain things, of course you don't.
Exactly.
But yeah, maybe it's exactly what you were saying. Maybe we have read so many stories that are always kind of like similar stories that it gets to a point that you start reading something else. And when you go back, it's like, I've read so many of these.
I've read so many of these.
Yeah, it's true.
One of the genres that I don't tend to do, I dip back into every once in a while, but that's romance. And it's not because let me rephrase that. It is because I personally get super triggered by a lot of the power dynamics in romance novels, and they bother me and I get very upset. I can feel my blood pressure changing. Yes. And so I've just decided every once in a while, I'll try one. My one-star review of The Duke and I on on Goodreads. I'm still mad about it. I have strong feelings. I really enjoyed watching Bridgerton, but I also have very strong feelings about some of the things that happen in that book and in that show. And I've read some Julia Quinn that was published later. And they're just lovely stories that don't involve coercion or mind games or any of that. And those I was perfectly fine with, but the, you know, seduction as an aggressive technique just does not turn my crank. So I tend to stay away from romance novels specifically for that reason.
Yeah. I for me, it was kind of like almost the opposite. I used to be mostly a detective and romance reader, but it got to a point as well in which, unfortunately, for some reason, like, I sometimes you pick up a book and I'm interested more in queer stories because I've read so much straight romance that after a while you're like, okay, what does this book have to offer me that I haven't read before, since I've read so much romance? And then and then it's like, okay, if it's a queer story, it's not the same story. And I used to be a big Nicholas Sparks fan. It was like my favorite growing up. And then, you kind of realize that, well, the author itself is problematic, but I still pretty much enjoy the writing. And again, we go into gatekeeping. And sometimes, you know, we have a tendency to mock certain things. But then I think about it, it's like, I know that his writing is not going to be for everyone. But if I am being fair to myself and honest, I know that I still, if I pick up one of his books nowadays, I still enjoy the writing.
Sure.
So,
and I think that's perfectly okay. And this is where, Yeah, we can dive into the gatekeeping. Although yeah. I do want to, have you read One Last Stop by Casey McQuiston?
Not yet, actually. I have it on my audiobook because I do want to read it this year.
Definitely. It's so cute. Yeah. I loved it so much.
Except that people were just complaining because there was a female-female romance instead of male-male. Like, you know, red, white, and no, red, white.
Like red, white, no, and
blue, white, and royal. No.
Red, white, and royal blue.
Royal blue. Yes, thank you.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
And it was.
You know what? There is a weird thing about women, specifically white women, is my experience.
Yeah.
But there's this weird thing about women writing male-male romances that has like an icky, it gives me an icky feeling mm-hmm. of voyeurism that I don't like.
Because I do think the issue is the book was very popular and a lot of women picked it up thinking it was going to be male on male. And I remember one TikTok video clearly stating, oh, I was expecting to be attracted to the men in the story and therefore to enjoy seeing them together. And I kind of thought this is the same kind of voyeurism about guys who are extremely homophobic, but then want to see two women having intercourse because they're hot. And I thought, this is so bad, though. It's so bad.
Yeah, I think we women have a lot of inherited cultural, specifically male homophobia. There's an element there. There's all sorts of like homophobic and also weird misogynistic thoughts about that, right? Yeah. Like being interested in male-male romance, like there's an aspect of it where I have gay friends and I would love to see, I like watching romances that reflect their own lives. Like I want them to be happy too. And this is a cake and frosting way to represent that. And I think that that's important. Mm-hmm. Everybody deserves to be happy and see themselves represented in literature. And women who get upset that there is a female-female romance versus a male-male romance may have a little bit of work to do. Also, there's an element of I'm not allowed to be a part of that. So this is a safe relationship for me to watch. And that is where I think the misogyny comes in, mm-hmm. where women's relationships with men specifically are often unsafe, either emotionally or physically. They're difficult. And so I understand wanting to see a romance that you don't have to be a part of at all.
Yeah, of course. Definitely. Definitely.
So it's just a very, there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. But I'm sorry, you were going to talk about gatekeeping and One Last Stop. And then I just thought of that. So carry on.
No, I think it all rolls together. So I don't even remember. Was it somebody? Oh, I do remember. A few months ago, this article came out in Jezebel, which for me goes back and forth and up and down, but it was also one of my first entrees into online feminism. Yeah. So, you know, Jezebel holds a special place in my heart, but there was this article about how bookstagrammers and book Twitter and people who use hashtags are ruining reading for everybody.
Is it the, we have to save books from the book people?
Yes.
That's the one, right? Yeah.
Yes. And
it was so curious because when I saw your article on Book Riot in response to that, I didn't even need to read. As soon as I saw the title, I was like, I know it is because of that article, because it made me so angry.
It's so ridiculous. Like, A of all, this is the same thing where you're saying you're like somebody's music, somebody's writing is bad versus it's just not for me. Like there is objectively bad writing. And then there's writing that just like doesn't hook you as a human being, as a person in the world. Well, those are two different things. Yeah. There's a Venn diagram of overlap.
Of course.
But those are two different things. Just let people enjoy things. If I want to take a cute photo of myself sipping my tea and reading my book, it doesn't make my book reading experience any less impactful to me. Like, it's just, this makes me very angry. I'm sorry. And The only thing that I agree with, and this is because I'm a deeply logical and super pedantic person, is the hashtag am reading. Because if you're hashtagging, you aren't actually reading. You're hashtagging.
That is true.
And
that
is me being an insufferable pedant.
like every time someone posts a story on Instagram saying currently reading, they are not currently reading. And I think about that myself. Like
Right. And like, I'm not gonna crawl up anybody's butt about that one. Like, it's fine. It's just me being like, well, actually, you're not. Saying that book people are ruining reading tells me that you are spending too much time on the internet trying to police people who are just trying to enjoy their lives.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's all that is. Exactly.
But like, just let people enjoy things. It's not that hard.
It's a curious thing because I have a tendency of becoming angry at people who are angry about other things. So basically it's like, why are people angry about Christmas? Like, people are so cynical about Christmas, about Valentine's Day, about Women's Day, etc., etc. And I really get angry about the people being angry that you're just doing something harmless, I don't know, to make a day more special. Because, of course, Valentine's Day is every day. But then, like, you have your birthday, even though you're happy, I hope, to be alive every day, you celebrate it a little more on your birthday. Yeah. So I really get angry at that. So I have a tendency, like, for example, and I talked about this on Slack as well. I got a bit upset with people making fun of Insta poetry because I've read Rubikaur's first two books.
I remember this.
I really like them. Like, the last one, I didn't like as much. But I do believe that, people, it does, just because it is Insta poetry and it's, available immediately online, doesn't necessarily mean it has to be good. And I think what bothers me the most is the kind of like snob elitist way people look at things, thinking they are better than any of that and above all that. And things are usually harmless. And then I did figure out that, I don't like a lot of Insta poetry as much as I thought I did. But still, I'm not going to say if someone is making a lot of money with that because they had got lucky that they got, that people enjoy what they're writing and it means something to them. Yeah, I just feel it's so mean to just put people down. That's not poetry. That's not writing.
It's ridiculous. Like, that kind of behavior is ridiculous. Firstly, because we have this idea that we have the canon. And when I was younger, I believed very strongly in the canon and I didn't think things should be added to it. And it was nonsense. It's absolute nonsense because the people who created the canon, like, first of all, most of the writing that is being done right now will have been lost in 100 years. Mm-hmm. It just simply won't exist. And the writing that does exist, if you look back at the writing that we have from the 19th century, a lot of the writing that does exist still is because those authors got popular.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have anything to do with whether the writing is objectively better than any other writing that was going on at the time.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think about that in terms of what is going on right now. Like, Instagram poetry and Twitter poetry, right? Like, there is something specifically on Twitter, and this is before they went to, I don't know how many characters you can have now, but it jumped significantly in the last couple of years.
280. So it went from 140 to 280.
Yes, they doubled it.
Yeah.
Right. So specifically 140 characters, like, some really amazing, poignant things came out when you only had 140 characters to go.
Yeah.
And putting, Instagram doesn't actually have limits on how many characters you can use. So that changes things a little bit, but there is a limit to how much you can see in that little square easily and be able to read and want to flip through. Right. So that brevity, it has always been appreciated. I mean, haiku is one of the highest forms of poetry in Japanese and other Asian countries and languages have their own version of very truncated poetry. And being able to express something in few words is, it's really an incredible skill and magical.
Yep.
And so to say all of a sudden that like the kids are doing this and they should or shouldn't be able to make any money off of it, it's garbage. It goes right along with the idea of that artists should suffer for their art.
Yeah.
And no reason for that.
No. I also hate that.
It's trash.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that. No, I'm very happy that like mental awareness is, you know, we have much, much more mental awareness nowadays than they had a few years ago even. So I'm so happy for that. Because I also don't think it is worth. I was actually reading a book by someone that talked about it and I don't remember anymore who it was, but like it's not worth just giving up on your mental health for the sake of the art. Like,
yes. And in the same way that if you have a barn and you want a barn cat, you should feed your barn cat, because they will kill more mice and rodents if they are well fed and happy than if they are purely surviving on eating the mice and other rodents that they find in the barn.
Mm-hmm.
They will not be as effective of a barn cat. So in the same way, artists who can pay their rent, can buy their own food, who are not struggling every day just to make a dollar or a euro, artists who are not struggling are more prolific and they make better art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so, makes all sense, of course.
Right? Like, once you've got your, like, basic needs met, you can engage your imagination and your higher forms of thought, and you're not stressed out all the time. There's no reason for it. And the idea that artists need to struggle and suffer is born out of, I think, jealousy in a large, large way, because they have this talent. And in order to have the talent, you have to pay for it somehow. And the way mm-hmm. that we want them to pay for it is to suffer.
I think I'm going to use, like, this is very profound, but I think I'm going to use it as a segue to go into the fact that you are a knitter. Because that was my next question.
Sure.
Speaking of art.
Speaking of art, yes. What a good segue. Well done.
How did you pick up that hobby?
I started knitting in, I think, the mid 2000s. So the usual knitting story is my mom or my grandma or my aunt taught me. And, you know, I did it as a kid and then I just kind of picked it up again one day. I did not have that experience. Although I vaguely recall both of my grandmothers trying to teach me to do crafty things. My mom is a very, very talented tailor and quilter. She's always worked with fabric. So I have had that around in my whole life. I cannot sew a straight line to save my life. I can sew on a button. but most of the time, if it's not a very simple repair, I end up taking my stuff to my mom and begging for help. But I was never particularly successful at being crafty when I was growing up. I tried. I just wasn't very good at it. Mm-hmm. And in the mid 2000s, I decided that I was going to learn to knit. Dang it. So I found a website called knittinghelp.com, because in the mid 2000s, websites were very simply named.
Just straight to the point.
Straight to the point. And it has like a little like 20-second video of every stitch. And you can just watch that video on a loop. And so I learn visually. So I tried to learn from books and that didn't work. So I was like, well, how do you get from picture one to picture two? That doesn't make any sense. So I just watched those videos over and over and over again until I got it. And then I taught my mom to knit.
Oh, wow.
And so now we are both knitters. And she gets very tickled when we go to yarn stores together and people say like, oh, did you teach your daughter to knit? And she's like, no, she taught me. She learned.
Yeah.
And so I got my degree in art history, and I was particularly interested in textiles because, you know, let's go off book. let's not talk about paintings and sculptures. Let's talk about textiles.
Yeah.
And knitting was a way for me to quiet, again, that hamster wheel in the back of my brain. It gives me something to do with my hands while I am listening to a lecture. It helps me with my patience. One of the things that knitting taught me is you can always rip something out and start over again. It's taught me that mistakes just happen for whatever reason. And to be able to go back and fix it is a skill. And that sounds really, it sounds cheesy, but if you're knitting a sweater and you put an extra inch on it, like you can just rip it out and it's fine. So I've been doing that and also listening to a lot of audiobooks ever since then. Because I tend to knit and I also got into spinning. So now I own a spinning wheel.
Wow. It's like your own fairy tale.
I know. During COVID, people were doing big clear outs of their houses. And so I got a gorgeous loom. I bought a loom.
Wow.
So now I can like spin and weave my own fabric. The loom is not set up. It needs to be completely taken apart and cleaned.
Is it like a big one?
It's a big one,
yeah.
Like the size of a dining table.
Yeah, my grandmother was a weaver and she had like a really huge one. So that's really cool.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I bought it because one of my good friends went to the California College of the Arts for weaving. And so she has a tendency to troll Craigslist and kind of look for good deals on looms. And the Berkeley Weavers Guild is world famous. So there are a lot of weavers in this area. And she found this loom. It is a $3,500 loom. And yeah, she found it for $300.
Yeah.
and so she was like, you should buy this, just buy it and we'll fix it and it'll be fine. And then, so I did. And now I need to take it apart and clean it and put it all back together, but I just haven't started yet.
Yeah, but it's a cool project to look forward to.
I know,
as well.
I'm super excited. I'm super excited to do it
again while listening to audiobooks as well.
Exactly. So, I do a lot of textiles along with reading books. And then during COVID, I know you didn't ask me about this part, but during COVID last June, I adopted a kitten because that's Wogglebug, because my nieces. We're like, Aunt Tika, look at these kittens we're going to take home. And I was like, oh, you guys, they're so cute. What adorable kittens you're going to have. I have two cats. And they were like, we know. And this kitten doesn't have a home.
Oh, all sad.
Yeah. I know. So now, and I looked at my niece's mom and she was just howling in the back. She was laughing so hard. And I was like, well, I guess he does now.
what you're going to do. I mean,
yes. So, but adopting this particular kitten, he's very rambunctious and he is pugnacious. And so I had to stop knitting for almost a year because I couldn't knit. He would just like get into everything. I've had to put all of my yarn, like my other two cats don't care. They're perfectly fine with yarn being around the house. But now with Bug, like it has to be in a box and the box has to be taped shut.
I'm pretty certain he doesn't mind either. I mean, you know.
Not mind. But he will go digging and like he'll dig out a skein of yarn and he'll like tear it up and like tangle it. I have actual boxes full of yarn that he has just like tangled to no end. And I know there's one person on Book Riot Slack who was like, I love untangling yarn. And I was like, you should not tell me that because I will send you a giant box full of yarn that needs to be untangled. And she was like, don't threaten me with a good time. So I started getting into watercolors. I picked up an art that I never thought I would be interested in. So I tend to just pick things up because of like random circumstances in my life and then continue on. So now he's calmed down. He's a little bit over a year old and he'll let me knit a little bit, but then it generally goes very poorly for me after that. If I walk away from my yarn, it will be in another room. So unraveling. I have to be careful. Yes.
So, but yes. Do you keep your hobbies? Because I abandon everything. I embroidered. Oh. I started knitting. I still say that I embroider, but I haven't embroidered in many, many months, maybe a year.
That's nothing. That's nothing. It's going to be there forever. Like, it's not like it's going to go bad. If you said, I got super into cake decorating and I bought all this fondant and then I haven't used it. Like, maybe that's when you need to rethink like the way that you approach your hobbies. But
I do have like pieces of wool, yarn, actually. Sorry, I was just relating. So I have yarn in the house that I haven't used in maybe 3-4 years, and I don't think I'm gonna go back to it. So,
I mean, just pass it along to somebody who might.
Yeah, because then I kind of kept it because I started weaving as well, and I haven't weaved anything.
Mm-hmm. I didn't finish anything.
So there you go. You kind of start the hobby, and now I was even considering starting making soaps. So everyone who kind of keeps a hobby for, you know, longer than 6 months, I'm like awed by it. So it's curious that you're now talking like, okay, you're knitting, but then you kind of had to stop because of the cat and you started with the watercolors. And you also use it while listening to audiobooks.
Mm-hmm. That's really the key, is it's just a thing to keep my brain busy while I listen to books.
Yeah, because I wanted to talk to you about like you talked about the intersection between books and crafts.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to like expand on that?
I can. I think that novels in particular have always been a very, they've always been aimed towards women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of crafts, we think of them as crafts now, but, and that word kind of gets denigrated. It's just a craft. It's just your hobby. But before the Industrial Revolution, the creation of textiles was paramount. It was incredibly important on a day-to-day level for everybody, because if you don't have clothes, you don't stay alive.
Of course.
And so the ability to tell stories, like there was always somebody who was telling a story while women were sitting around and doing they weren't sitting around in that sense, but they were working on their weaving. They were working on spinning. They were working on knitting. They were creating clothing for people. And, you know, quilting bees are a thing that comes out of that. You know, I think about Pride and Prejudice where, you know, somebody, was it Pride and Prejudice? It might've been Sense and Sensibility, where, you know, one person in the group is reading a story to everybody after dinner. And then other people are kind of picking up, it was Sense and Sensibility. Other people are picking up like weaving a little thing for a hat or embellishing, you know, a bonnet or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that is an intersection that we have had for literally thousands of years, because we want to be able to interact and to share stories and to share experiences. And there's also work to be done. And when you're cooking, and when you're doing other things that are required to keep a household moving and to keep people fed, it's not quite the same. Like, I live by myself, and so I can listen to an audiobook while I'm cooking or doing dishes. But kitchen work is much more of a group activity.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I am working on a knitting project, it's kind of just me, and other people will gravitate towards me with their own knitting projects. And we will talk about those.
Yeah.
But, you know, once we're all done gossiping and sharing information, somebody is just going to start telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the intersection there is that specifically spinning wool, but also knitting. And once, you know, check with me in a year to see if that loom is still sitting in my garage. People have been spinning since Neolithic times. They find so many spindle weights in Neolithic villages during archaeological digs that you can buy them on eBay. And this is something that somebody 10,000 years ago was using to create fabric to keep themselves warm over winter. And so for me, as an art history major, and as a person who has always been involved in textiles, I feel like there's no difference between books and craft, because they naturally gravitate towards one another, and they just go together.
That's very beautiful.
Thank you.
It is. It's kind of like, I remember talking to you about this, the intersection, and kind of curious to hear you talk about it, like what would be your approach to it or what you're going to say about it. And yeah, it is true. That's what people did back in the day. They told mm-hmm. stories.
I also really love spinning because it makes me feel connected to all of the people who have come before me, who have done this. Like, this is an actually ancient prehistoric thing that I am doing, and I'm just doing it for fun. But it also connects me, like, you know, even the language that we use, where, you know, you're connected by a thread.
Yeah.
And it becomes a literal thread. And the other thing about spinning that I thought was really interesting and did not expect when I learned how to do it is that almost overnight I stopped being afraid of spiders.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
Because we both spin. And so now they're my friends. Now, I will say, if it jumps or if it is too hairy or too large, it gets gently escorted outside.
Excuse me. Go knead somewhere else. As much as possible. No, yes. Go spin somewhere
Please?
Else.
Please. No, thank you. But I'm not afraid of them anymore. And that was a really unexpected bonus, because I never really understood why I was afraid of spiders.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm just not.
I had a different approach. My approach was more like the shock approach. I started being afraid of spiders when I was 9 years old and I saw arachnophobia on TV.
Yes.
And then I was checking my shoes and my socks and I really became afraid of spiders. And then I worked as a cleaning lady for 8 years and I bumped into spiders so often while cleaning the corners with the vacuum cleaner that at some point I was like, what are they going to do to me? What? Okay. I don't like you. If they're too hairy or too big, I don't like them. Like, I still don't really like spiders, but most of the time they're just like, yeah, okay, you're there. I'm here. I'm fine.
We're just living in the world, trying to do our best out here.
Yeah, it's but fine. It's so curious, that connection that you're making now with spinning. And of course, so do the spiders.
Yes.
Such a fun, like a fun way to not be afraid of them anymore.
Also. It was a really surprising, like all of a sudden I was like, oh, this is a sisterhood. And I was like, this doesn't make it like,
yeah,
it doesn't make any more sense than anything else. Yeah. But it worked for me, which was good, because as I said, I live by myself and those spiders need to be escorted outside by somebody, and that somebody is going to be me. So
not one of the cats for sure.
No.
You are talking about sisterhood, and I would really like for you to talk about the witch renaissance.
Oh,
that you're involved with, right? Like,
yes, I am. I don't. Okay. So.
Explain what it is, because I was kind of doing some research, but I'm not completely sure I know exactly. So just,
I think we are in, you know, the beginning, maybe transitioning into the middle stages of this. So maybe nobody really knows what it is. But for me, it's about, so I grew up in a very religious Christian household, and it never really rang for me. And so I shifted to atheism at some point, but the instinct to pray for people and to hope for the best for them and to want good things for them, I don't think that is singular to religion, much less to any one religion.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was twofold. It was finding a way to put energy out into the universe on behalf of myself and on behalf of other people, and also doing that while not praying to a male deity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it starts to sound a little woo-woo.
I'm curious
which is
now.
Fine. You know, but I also, as an atheist and as a deeply practical person, I recognize that if I'm standing and lighting a candle for my friend who, you know, is dealing with a difficult situation, like that is not all I'm going to be doing for my friend. I'm going to be supporting her. I'm going to be talking to her. And I'm going to take this moment to think about her in the purest sense that I can come up with and light a candle. And like, it's about making space mm-hmm. For things for me. If nothing else happens, you know, like, let's say you are the most rational, scientific minded person. The only thing I've done is light a candle. And, you know, my like emotional energy, psychic energy, whatever, doesn't actually go anywhere out into the universe or make any changes. I still feel better. Mm-hmm. And I feel more equipped emotionally to help my friend. Mm-hmm. So it can't hurt. And it definitely helps. At least it helps me. And it helps keep me centered. And so I think that there has been a renaissance, partly because women are once again feeling somewhat powerless. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we are getting daily, we are experiencing the power of women daily. Mm-hmm. And it is a way to tangibly, physically regain power in a world where we have a lot less control over the world than we think we do, or, you know, we can even imagine.
Of course.
I think that that is what almost all religion is about.
Yeah.
Is about believing that there's really, you know, and if then, if you are a bad person, then you go to hell. There is justice in the world. And if there's not justice in this life, there will be justice in the life after.
Yeah.
And I think people turning to witchcraft is a way to experience and to help us feel like there is more justice in the world, and that we can perhaps sway that justice mm-hmm. without being part of something that's organized.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I do think that there are various ways of being spiritual without needing to be religious. And you can still believe in certain things and certain powers. Because do you also feel, I usually tend to say, because I was also raised Christian, right now I think that I am agnostic, or at least I'm mm-hmm. not religious anymore. And I always say that you can take me, how do they say it? Like, you can take me out of the Catholicism, but you can't take the Catholicism out of me, in the sense that I always say that I don't believe, but if I'm flying, and I'm really afraid of flying by plane, of course, because I can't fly, like, but like, if I'm flying, I'm on a plane trip and something happens, my first instinct is to start praying, and I cannot fight that. Even though I say, I don't really believe it, I cannot fight it.
I think that's exactly what we're talking about. You know, that instinct to, I think that somebody who, if I were to get into an argument, you know, a discussion with mm-hmm. somebody who does believe in deities, that they would probably say to me that I have made the universe into a deity, because that is what I'm asking for help in that moment. Mm-hmm. Right. But I don't think that the specific entity matters.
No.
You know, once we realize as humans that we are in a situation where we don't have control, we have two options. We can run over people to regain control, right? This is where you find people who are very controlling in their day-to-day lives, or, you know, colloquially, they are control freaks, those sorts of things. And those kinds of people they can be very difficult mm-hmm. and they can be dangerous. Or you can ask for help.
Yeah, of course.
And if you can't ask your fellow humans for help, who do you ask for help?
Yeah, exactly. Because I do think religion, a lot of religion, like what I really dislike about religion is, like you said, the group kind of almost cult feeling that you get from it, but also the pointing fingers and everything is a sin. I think it's so oppressive, like the whole oppression I have no patience for. But I also think that sometimes, especially, as I said, if you are raised without knowing anything else, like if you know about the asking for things, I do think that religion sometimes, when you're desperate and you can't believe in the facts and that, you know, the facts are going to save you from something, sometimes you do have a need to turn to something that can kind of make a miracle or perform a miracle for you. And a lot of people have that need.
And miracles happen.
Yeah.
You know, there is more mystery in this world than there is fact, even though there is so much more fact and we understand so much more than we did, you know, even 100 years ago, much less, you know, when Shakespeare was writing Hamlet and talking about, you know, more in heaven and earth. It's just, there is a place for the things that we do not yet understand and that we may never as humans understand. But I do believe that we are all connected. I believe that there is an element of interconnectedness among people, just like a stand of birch trees are all connected under the ground, but they are individual trees. And that is magical.
Yeah.
And not in the sense of, you know, I'm doing magic, like throwing things into a cauldron or whatever, but like, it's unexplainable and it's fascinating and it's just magic. And I think that for me, witchcraft represents that appreciation of the unknown and how interesting that is and how intricate nature is. I've found myself getting a lot more deeply into plants. One of the reasons that I chose to learn about watercolor is that I wanted to do, and I still do, botanical illustration. I'm over here with my cats and my knitting and my botanical illustration, like living my best Beatrix Potter life, right? But she wrote books and I will not. So just so we're clear. But I think, you know, I'm learning about plants and just the way that they communicate with one another. And it's just magical. And I love that.
Have you read Braiding Sweetgrass?
No.
By Robin Wall Kimmerer, because one of the things that I got from that book is there is she talks about, like, for example, something that science can't really prove, but she truly, honestly believed that it is true, which is the fact that they did an experiment and it was like two allotments growing plants, or in the, I think it was some kind of plant. And one of the allotments, the person doing this experiment simply planted and watered it. And on the other allotment, she also talked to the plants. And the allotment, when she talked to the plants grew better and stronger. And the thing is, you cannot prove this by science. You cannot tell to a science committee, I talked to this plant, so they grew better. But I do believe that, like, when you put kindness and time and words into something, even if it's like, it seems crazy to, you know, to the factual world that we believe in. I do believe that that brings you something. And she talks a lot about that because she's a native woman, but she's also a scientist. And she brings the science and the nature and the native knowledge together. And it's such a beautiful book because it's so poetic as well. And she talks about that, about the energy that we give to things, that it's not just catering to their needs with water and food, but your kindness and your words and your time.
I think that intention matters. It doesn't always matter, right? There are times when, like, your attention, your intention is good and the outcome is like you called the cops on black people, like an asshole, right? But intention does matter most of the time, unless it ends up doing harm, in which case, you know, you have to make reparations for that.
Of course.
And I think that, you know, maybe in the science-minded part of me is saying, you know, a person who just, you know, you could say, like, these two different people in their different allotments, like, they're going to spend the same amount of time with the plants, perhaps, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that that would be a key normalizer for that. But somebody who is like, as humans, we love to personify things and to anthropomorphize things. And so once I have made friends with my plants, I am going to pay more attention to them. I'm going to be more inquisitive about what's going on with them. Whereas if I was just like growing, I have plants that I have made friends with, and then I have plants that I'm just kind of growing because I think they're kind of fun. And I know that I pay, and I'm looking at them right now, right? I know that I pay closer and more careful attention to the plants that I have like arbitrarily made friends with. And I don't know necessarily if one plant is doing better than the other, but there are certainly ones that I will check on more often. And then I get into my routine of caring for my plants. So everybody gets cared and watered, but I'm noticing things about certain ones more than the other. And that intention has weight. It just does. And I don't know if that's, it's got to be some kind of science, but maybe we just don't have the, tools to measure like intention and energetic vibes.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what we have crystals for.
Yes. But that's what she was saying. Like, this comes from things that we learn as natives since, you know, God, since, you know, along
prehistory.
This. Yeah. And it's something that you believe in. And
yes,
but you can't prove. And that was a bit of a problem with like a science committee because of that. And it kind of reminded me of this because one thing that I wanted to also ask is, because I'm a very pragmatic person, I usually say, well, I'm a Capricorn, so I only care about facts. But the truth is that even though I am a Capricorn and I'm supposed to not be moved, and I will say to anyone that I'm not moved by feelings, feelings, I don't even have feelings. I'm a Capricorn. Anyway,
I only have one feeling. You're getting on my one nerve, my one feeling.
No, but like what I want to, I really like everything esoteric. So you give me tarot, I love it. Give me star signs, love it. But I don't believe in anything. Okay.
Right.
Right.
And that is, you know, that's fine.
But I love it. So I wondered, is it also like this witch renaissance that you were talking about? Does it also come with kind of practicing? And I'm saying, listen, I want to take away the idea of, you know, that what you see in movies and what people have in their heads about witchcraft. But I really mean about doing like some cleansing or putting like a candle at a certain time, or even with plants like you were talking. Is this something you also do? I'm really interested.
I do. No, I appreciate that. And I think I do. And I again, you know, I don't know necessarily that smoke cleansing my house does anything besides make me feel like a fresh start.
It's already something, but, I guess. I
mean, but that's already something, you know, if I've had a really bad breakup, or I've had, you know, a rough argument with a friend or something inside my space, feeling like you were packing up the visual memory, you know, people tend to rearrange their rooms when they've had a bad experience, and it just changes the visual memory of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And the way that, you know, if I'm not going to rearrange my living room after I have an argument with my sister, I can wave some scented herbs and make it smell clean and open the windows and blow the bad vibes out the door. And if that makes me feel like I can reset and approach the problem from a more tender and less activated emotional state, then that is all the, like, and again, I put air quotes around this, like, in that sense, that's all the magic that I need.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to feel in control in a physical, tangible sort of way. As a visual person, it helps me to feel that. And I think that that's kind of all. And so tarot, I love tarot cards. I think they tend to be beautiful.
Yes.
I think that they're really interesting. Mm-hmm. Their history is much, much, much shorter than we think. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not ancient, they're just old. But people have been doing divination, you know, again, since Neolithic times. And the reason is that they need to feel some sort of control over the world. And they need to know, you know, what's going to happen. And I tend to use tarot not as a divination tool, but as a like, this thing is on my mind. Can you give me some ways to to focus on it differently? Yeah. And that helps. And I think just if you, like the small act of saying, like, you get to ask one question, ask the future, ask the cards one question. What is that question? Just the answer, just the question that you come up with gives you a direction to move in about mm-hmm. what is weighing most heavily on your mind. And that has power also, even if the cards don't tell you anything you didn't already know. Mm-hmm. And so I think just it's about like taking a minute to, or taking some time to think about what is important to you and to focus on it and to assign it the time and energy that something that is important to us deserves. Mm-hmm. Yep. 'Cause a lot of times we'll be like, I'll get to it. It's important to me. I've labeled it as important and now I cannot pay attention to that thing. Mm-hmm. Because I know it's important and there's all these other little things that need to be taken care of. And it helps me to take time at the beginning of my day. I will send you, Jada Pinkett Smith has a wonderful Instagram and she posted a video a couple of days ago that actually brought me to tears. And it was this video of her saying, every day you need to do this thing. And then she like wraps herself in a bear hug. And she talks to herself about how much she loves herself and like how much she's going to take care of herself. And it like with her eyes closed and it was just this beautiful, like, let me love on you. Like it's us, right? Like we are here together. And it made me cry because we don't do that enough. Mm-hmm. I don't do that enough. And so I immediately wrapped that into my routine in the morning of getting up, making coffee, lighting a candle for the day. Like I light a stick of incense that smells like pine trees. And so it kind of like clears up the house and it, you know, that smell now smells like morning. Yeah. And it smells like, okay, we're getting it together. We're getting to work. And I wrapped that hug and that self-affirmation into it. And my day has gotten so much better. And it feels ridiculous to do. And I'm really glad I don't have a roommate, but it helps. And like those things aren't really super quantifiable.
No, not at all. Of course, there's no science behind it.
So, I mean, I'm sure there's psychology behind it, but even like hard scientists will tell you that psychology is nonsense, or at least some of it is. So, you know, it just depends. Proved.
Yeah.
Right.
In some ways it can't. In some ways it's more like observational.
Right.
Yeah. You can take a lot of conclusions from observing people and yeah.
Right. And everybody's bringing their own biases to those observations. And so it's not, you know, you and I are going to come away with two probably very similar, but slightly different conclusions.
Of course. Yeah.
How
did you, like, I want to ask you two things about this. If you have any resources to people who would like to start on, you know, witch renaissance and learn more about it, I'm pretty certain there are a lot of people who are interested in it. But also, how did you start? Was it something that you started long ago?
No, it wasn't really. I had a friend and I just went over to my library to make sure that I haven't loaned out the books that I was going to recommend. I had a friend who was into it. She was in the middle of a bad emotional romantic situation. And so she asked her two best friends she asked two of us to come over to make a group of three to have drinks. And then she was like, I just want to like clear this space. And I found it so charming. And so we started talking about things and I was like, you know what? I can light a candle for this. Like I come from a Catholic background.
Yeah.
I'll light a candle. Like there's nothing witchier than the Catholic sensibility of like lighting a candle to mm-hmm. pray for somebody. Yeah. So, you know, that folded right in. And I will admit, or I should just confess or say, I had friends about 10 years ago. I had a couple of really good friends who were super into tarot, and I was insufferable about it.
Well, it's karma. It's kind of like
this. It really is. Like, this is one of those things where I am learning as I get older, like, to try really hard just to be excited that people are excited about things.
Yeah.
But if it's not my jam, it's fine. Because if I am judgmental and insufferable about something, inevitably it's something that I get into and I become really interested in. And then I just look like a hypocritical jackass. And so to those people who, there's no way they're going to hear this, but I offer up, offer up these apologies to the universe and to those people, because like, what a jerk.
I do think we all have our biases. Like, I mean, I'm right? also like, I get super excited about talking about esoteric things, but then you ask me, do you believe? And I'm like, no.
No.
I mean, you know.
I really like watching people get excited about things. I don't really care what the thing is. Mm-hmm. But if you're a big nerd about, I don't know, one of my good friends is a huge nerd about soldering techniques. She like puts together circuit boards and stuff, and she does all these really interesting, she's interested in the intersection between textiles and electronics. Mm-hmm. So she's building, I have a purse. My favorite purse has a black lining. Mm-hmm. She is building me like a sewable insert into my purse so that I can turn on the light and find something in my purse, right?
Which wow.
is right.
Super like, handy yes, as well. Wow.
Super handy, right? And so, you know, we're talking about it and she's talking about like all of these different techniques that you can use to like solder things together and like build motherboards and microchips and all this stuff. And I'm just sitting here watching her like be super excited about it and asking her as many questions as I can. And she's like off, like out in the middle of nowhere. But just watching her get super excited about things and want to share that information is enough to get me interested and excited about things.
Yeah.
And so the major difference between insufferable me getting snooty about somebody's tarot cards, like the difference of those 10 years is being able to say, I love that you love this thing. I'm not into it. Doesn't make any sense to me, but I want to hear more. Convince me. Yeah. Instead of dismissing things that people enjoy.
Yeah. And if it's harmful, I mean, they're not harming anyone. So just be happy. Not
hurting anybody. Like, just let people live their lives.
Yeah.
And I think this is something, you know, especially as women, we are raised to be judgmental and harsh and critical of one another.
Yeah.
And deciding to abandon that criticism and just be interested in people where they are and meeting them where they're at has taken so much stress out of my life.
Yeah. No, yeah, definitely. Because you don't mind anymore. Like that, it's time that you are actually wasting being angry at something that is so harmful and harmless. And why? What for?
Right. I might as well, like, I can direct my anger at places that actually deserve it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I can direct my anger towards needing political change and needing financial change and reform and those sorts of things, and not on whether somebody's long nails are weird to me. Like, it doesn't matter. Just, you know, stop gatekeeping. Just let people live.
Exactly. And my next question is,
sure,
do you like put your anger on the boxing? I don't even know the name. What's the boxing? Where you, the boxing. Yeah, but the boxing thing.
On the bag?
The bag. Do you put that anger on the bag? No, I just want to talk about it with
I
you.
I do. Okay.
You practice so boxing. So I really do, wanted to talk about it.
I did. Ugh, my poor arms. I worked so hard on my arms. I was so proud of them. And then like a year and a half of not going to the boxing gym. And now they like, I'm like one of those cartoons where like the guy has the muscle that like goes up and then like it goes like bloop and like hangs on the bottom now. Like those are my arms now. But I started boxing because one of my very good friends was boxing and she recommended that I try it. And I went to a boxing gym opened like right next to my work.
Yeah.
Which was great. And they had the perfect schedule. So I get off work at 5 o'clock and the boxing class starts at 5:30 and it lasts for 40 minutes. And then my bus was at like 6:25. Right. So like that timing is just like, it's like chef's kiss perfect.
Perfect.
So, and I was wearing my little Fitbit and it was like, you're burning like between 500 and 600 calories in 40 minutes. And I was like, sold. This is great. I will admit there have definitely been times where specific faces have been imagined onto the bag that I am hitting.
Great technique.
It was very effective. You know, it's better than a bullseye. But for the most part, I just find that it's harmless. It's not hurting anybody, but also gets you moving and it gets you, like, there is something about punching a thing where there are no consequences to doing so. And the outcome is that you get stronger. Like there's no downside to it for me, which is great. And you will appreciate this as a fellow pragmatist. I have always really, really wanted to like hurl a wine glass at the wall in a fit of pique. But the reason I've never done it is that I know I'll just have to clean it up later.
Yeah. And regrets. Because like sometimes, like, I don't know. Like, you know, people sometimes are mean and they can just have like a clear conscience about it. Every time that I react a bit more, let's say, for example, mean to people, I'm cycling and someone doesn't stop and I get all like, oh, you gotta stop. Like 5 seconds later, I'm regretting. Yep. I should have been nicer to the person because that could have been me. I could have made that mistake.
I've totally done that before. Or like, you know, like you're, yeah, like you don't wait your proper turn because you're in a hurry or you weren't paying attention or whatever. And like somebody else gets upset with you. Like, it's just not, I do that too. I get upset with those people as well. And then 5 seconds later, like you're saying, I'm like, I've totally done that.
Yeah. But the issue is that I always kind of, I try to remind myself, and I forget this very often, that it doesn't usually doesn't pay off to be angry at people in general, because when the situation is solved, it's super awkward. And then at least I speak for myself. I am left feeling super like regretful of being mean to the person, even if it's something that I mean the right. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yes, absolutely. It doesn't have anything to do with who's right or wrong at that point. It has to do with
attitude, like, I think.
Attitude. Yeah, for sure. And don't get me wrong, I get plenty pissed.
Yeah.
I get plenty mad about things. I am pretty easy to wind up about stuff, but day-to-day life things, I try really hard to remember that we're all just walking around in this world, mostly doing the best we can. And sometimes the best I can is not my best, but it's the best that I can manage in that moment. And one of the other realizations that has really helped me is, and I think this, again, this comes with getting older and no longer being a teenager, because they talk about how teens, one of the stereotypes of teenagers is that like, they're always performing because they think that everybody's looking at them. But that's actually a thing that happens in your brain when you're that old. And so, you know, your brain is making changes to the way that you perceive the world. And so having grown out of that and realizing that like nobody on the street is paying any attention to me if I'm just walking around, like living my life, mostly because while I'm walking down the street thinking about that really stupid thing I said when I was 15 years old, everybody else is doing exactly the same thing. They're busy worrying about their lives. Like, I may be the heroine in my own novel, but they're the heroes and heroines in their novels.
Yeah.
And I'm just a side character. And so that actually helps me to feel like I can just do my own thing.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't really matter. It's not affecting anybody else.
I think one good thing about growing old is that you stop caring so much about what others think about you, but also about what you do in general. You just don't care as much. And it's so freeing.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is.
I wanted to ask you where people can find you online.
I am pretty easy to find online. I am Tika Bell with an E at the end, T-I-K-A-B-E-L-L-E. On Instagram, I'm on Facebook, but not very often these days. I write for Book Riot, and I think that's about it. I have a Twitter, which I mostly use to retweet angry things.
And there's a lot in the book community to retweet.
Angry political things, being in the U.S. It's died down a little bit, you know, since January, but so I would say probably people can find me on Instagram. I am currently doing, my friend who introduced me to boxing and I agreed this year to do the one post every day, 365 project. So there's a lot of art and a lot of cats in that. I tend not to take pictures of the books that I'm reading because I read on an e-reader most of the time, especially now when everything's in lockdown and the libraries have been closed. So, you know, getting a picture of my Nook or my Kindle every day of my book it's just not very interesting.
Doesn't have the same effect. Yeah, it's like,
no.
At the end of this month, I wanted to do a picture of a stack of the books that I had read in last month, and everything was digital.
It's just not as cool.
Definitely doesn't work.
No, it's, I was on, Litzy. I loved Litzy for a while. And that was, but it was right around the time that I started reading on an e-reader.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of reading habits, like I used to be very hardcore. You have to have a book. Like I needed a book. I don't care how you read, but like I need a book. And then I realized that part of that was because I was lucky enough to work in a place, this is my previous job, where the library was open till 9 p.m. and they had it like you could reserve your books and they would throw them on the reserve shelf for you. So you just like swung into the library, ducked in, grabbed your books off the shelf, mm-hmm. checked them out, got in the car, went back home. Yeah. And the library was on the way home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could just swing into the library real quick, drop off my books, pick up the new ones and go home. When I moved to Oakland, I started taking public transit to work.
Yeah.
And the library is not easily accessible on my public transit route. And so I started checking out all of my ebooks instead. And so now I read almost exclusively on an e-reader. And it turns out like the experience is kind of different. But I've been reading a paper book now and my hands get tired holding my book open. Yeah.
Because the Kindle or any reader is so easy to have anywhere, in bed or whatever. You don't have to hold the pages open if you're eating either. Just hold it with one hand and you put it down. Yeah, that's true.
I was laughing at myself about that. Just like trying to hold my book open with your thumb and your pinky finger. And like my pinky finger was getting tired. And I was like, oh my God, you're such a wimp.
Listen, the pinky finger needs some boxing as well.
That's right. It does. I need my boxing gym to open up. I'll email them and let them know.
Now I wanted to ask you the last question that I always ask on the podcast. And it is a difficult question usually for book lovers, but an all-time favorite book and a book you would recommend right now.
Oh, geez. That is a difficult question. I like, as you were asking, I was thinking like, that's so easy. And then I have to actually say a title.
Yeah.
And that's tough.
I usually tell people that it doesn't have to be one, but like not 20, you know, like just, you know, a couple.
So one of my favorite books is The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins.
Mm-hmm.
I would strongly recommend it. I would also recommend his book, The Moonstone. And once you meet my favorite side character, her name is Miss Clack. She's amazing. So that would be a lot of fun. I'm looking at my bookshelves right now and kind of scanning through them. At one point, I would have said the Harry Potter series, and now I won't.
Yeah, I know.
That's...
Yeah, I know.
Why? Speaking of stupid hills to die on.
Yeah. Oh,
like that is just a right. Like, it's just a bad hill.
Why? It was. Oh my God.
It's just a bad hill.
It could have just been gone so well.
It could have. It like. Ugh.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's very upsetting. So yeah, I would go with, and again, I'm out here like recommending books by dead white dudes. but based on our conversation, I would say The Woman in White for sure is one of my very favorites. And of course, I'm going to come up with my all-time favorite book as soon as we stop recording. So I will send you a Slack message if I actually remember what that book is. Something I would recommend, I really enjoyed Alex E. Harrow's, what's it called? The Once and Future Witches.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked that book. And so she also wrote a book called The 10,000 Doors of January.
Yeah.
Which has this, have you read it?
No, but I've heard Anika talking about it so much that every time that I think about this author, my mind immediately goes Anika.
Yes.
Definitely, but I haven't read it. No,
it has. Okay, so there is this one, and this is not any sort of 10,000 doors, right? Lots of different doors,
yeah.
And it's to lots of different dimensions, right? And the most charming thing about this book is the way that she describes cats. She talks about how cats are the only creatures that are persistent through all of the portals and all of the worlds and all of the dimensions, and when your cat seems to disappear, they're the only creatures who can use doors whenever and however they like.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else needs to learn how to use them and to have a special skill in order to do so. And so when your cat disappears and you're like, but I thought you were just right here, they've just gone to check out their home in another dimension, and then they'll come right back.
What? They have another home in another dimension? Do they love another family besides me and...
It's hard to tell.
Yes. And I'm worried. It's a very good premise, though.
I loved that. I loved that so much.
It's a bit
every once in a while.
Like Coraline.
Yes.
Like they just
Except,
go, Coraline, you know, not, sorry, not Coraline. Yeah, but not in a creepy way. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Well, because like, as we were talking, right, my cat was sitting up on the on the chair behind me. And then when I got up to go upstairs to wash my hands, she was on the bed, and I hadn't even noticed her get up off of the chair while we were talking. And so it made me think of the 10,000 Doors of January, where she just like slid sideways into the other dimension for a minute and then came back and like went and lay on the bed.
I think they would like to have like four dinners or something.
Yes, absolutely. So I would recommend Alex Harrow. I would also recommend Nnedi Okorafor. Oh, I'm mispronouncing her last name. Shoot, hold on one second.
No, I do think you're saying it right. I think it is Okorafor.
There's no D in her last name. Or maybe Libby just misspelled it.
No, it's now I have to look there it up, is sorry. A D on the first name. On the like Nnedi is ND, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But then, yeah, the last name is Okorafor.
It's Okorafor.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So I would recommend the Binti trilogy by Nnedi Okorafor.
Very well.
It's wonderful.
I'm actually going to read a book by her, or by her. I don't know actually they're pronounced. So, I'm going to read Lagoon for a book club.
Mm.
And it's the first time because I am not a fantasy or science fiction reader. It's what I find the most difficult to read for me, unless it's dystopic. So I'm very curious about that. And I will make sure, of course, that I put everything in the show's notes. If you could also send me the books that you used for the witchcraft. Sorry, is this okay to say witchcraft?
Yeah, of course.
Then I could put them in the notes in case people want to check them out as well, because it's sure. It is very interesting.
I may just send you a picture of my entire bookshelf.
That is also fine. I'll just copy
that. I have my witch bookshelf. And some things are there, some things have been loaned out, but I have found several books that I tend to go back to over and over again. So I would be happy to send you those titles.
That's perfect. Then I can share it. Tika, thank you so much for this conversation. Had loads of fun talking to you.
You are so welcome. This has been lovely.
Thank you.
You can access today's show's notes via my pod page, which you can find along with all of my social media links at linktree.com/Karine Pereira. In there, you'll also find a link to a Story of Sorts playlist available on Libro.fm, containing the audiobooks recommended by our guests, which will be updated as the show progresses. If you'd like to give Libro.fm a try, you can use the code STORYOFSORTS at checkout to get 2 books for the price of 1. This offer is valid for new Libro.fm members in the US and Canada. Libro.fm is an audiobook platform which allows you to buy audiobooks directly from an indie bookstore. Check them out. If you have enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting A Story of Sorts on Patreon. Patreon is a platform which allows you to contribute monthly to the podcast in exchange for extra content, such as early access to episodes, a shout-out at the end of an episode and on Instagram, and choosing a theme for me to talk about on the podcast. You can become a patron at patreon.com/astoryofsorts. I'd also be very grateful if you would simply leave a review and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. As usual, I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new interview, but before that, I will be dropping an episode with the books I have read last month. I'll talk to you then, and thank you for listening.